Hello and welcome back to Back in My Play. I am Kevin Larrabee, and along with me for this episode, again, author of Console Wars, Blake J. Harris. Blake, how you doing?
I am great, Kevin. How are you?
Good. It feels like it's been a long time since we talked. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing or what.
I feel the same way. Time, it feels like years have passed in the past 2 months. But again, I don't know if that is a great development or a strange one.
Well, you've been going, you know, nonstop talking about the book, whether it be at, you know, bookstores or even you're on, like, it's kind of becoming our sister podcast, Player One Podcast. You're on there talking to those guys. Yep. And you've been talking a lot about Console Wars, and it's been great to see the awesome reaction from it. Like, even on Amazon.com, like, the reviews are overwhelmingly positive for the book, and people are really just really enjoying it.
Yeah, I know. I've been psyched about the response I've been getting, and I've pretty much been spending my time between doing promotion press stuff for the book, working on the documentary, and then working on the musical that I talked about on Player One Podcast that opens on Friday. So those three things are keeping me busy.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, just in case people didn't check out the interview on Player One. So how did you get involved in that? And obviously some details since it's coming up this Friday.
Sure. So when I was in the middle of researching and writing Console Wars, I began working on a musical about Wikipedia that was initially just called Wikipedia the Musical. And at first was kind of like this silly, goofy satire of the internet, almost like a series of Saturday Night Live sketches. But then sort of became actually like a story, like a digital age Alice in Wonderland story. And, you know, I'm not very musically inclined, but my writing partner, Frank Ceruzzi, who was my former high school English teacher, is. And together we put together the show, Wiki Musical, and submitted it to the New York Musical Theater Festival. And it opens on Friday, July 18th. And it's been a really exciting experience to dip my toes into something that I don't know anything about and work with great people to help put it together.
Well, it's got to be exciting. I mean, obviously, you're in the perfect area of the city of New York. So it's exciting. I don't know if do you have any like initial reactions so far? Is it picking up a lot of steam? I know I've been seeing you talk about that on some videos and stuff, as well as like we mentioned, the Player One Podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be picking up some steam. Because I am in New York, we have been able to attract a lot of great talent. The show stars Tony-nominated actress Brenda Braxton and a lot of just great cast and crew members that are willing to work for a small amount for the festival because they believe in the project. And we'll see. So far, the coverage has been great, but it's strange. It's unlike writing a book or unlike writing or producing a movie, because you really only have this performance, and it's much more ephemeral, and you know, hopefully it'll go great, but it's not like you have a tangible product or an asset at the end of it all that's just, you know, going to be there forever. So it's been a unique experience, but a fantastic one nonetheless.
Well, I'm curious, just talking about when we started talking through email and stuff like that, I wanted to do a follow up to our initial interview because, you know, 2 hours wasn't long enough. So I thought we could do, another hour to talk a little bit more about the reaction from the book and also some follow up to some of the things that we talked about. And one of the things just off the top of my head, I was really interested to see, since you did a lot of stuff on, you know, call it like the hardcore side of gamers and stuff like that, and more of just like the regular press. But what's the question that you're getting most often?
I mean, most people want to know why I wrote the book. I mean, that's probably been the biggest question. I think that the other one is, you know, sort of what prompted me to write the book, which is what happened to Sega? Why are they not the powerhouse that they were for a short period of time in the early 90s?
I've been going on to YouTube even last night and looking up some videos from whether it was the CES events and even early, the first couple of E3s, and just seeing the great competition between the two companies. Like at the earlier CESs, and you reference this in the book a lot, there's a great video. It's about a 10-minute long video that was from a Frontline episode on PBS, where they were going around and interviewing the big guys, like obviously Kalinske over at Sega and Howard over at Nintendo. And everyone, obviously except Nintendo, was just saying like, yeah, Nintendo is like not playing fair. They are monopolizing the industry. And Tengen is going as far as like saying, yeah, that's why we're, you know, going with Sega, because, you know, Nintendo has unfair business practices and stores won't carry our games and things like that. So that's where I wanted to kind of jump off into research for the documentary, because obviously you did a ton of stuff when it came to, you know, researching for the book. But has there been anything in the last couple of weeks that has been that has really stood out to you in terms of like, man, I can't believe whether, you know, Nintendo did this or Sega did this, or, you know, I can't believe these events occurred?
Yeah, I mean, that PBS Frontline piece is a really great example. That was, for me, visually and in terms of documentary, one of the best ways to introduce audiences to that other side of Nintendo. You know, when we start the film, we do try to bring you back to the Nintendo that you knew and loved when you were growing up. And sort of that PBS piece is a great example of the business side of things. You know, with the book, I tried to write much more of a universal story that did not really rely on nostalgia or anyone's own personal experience with these companies. But that's been the opposite with the documentary, you know, because there is such great media out there that does take you back. That's been the primary goal, is to really take you back. And it is probably much more targeted towards people that grew up in the 80s and 90s. In terms of the actual media, the thing that my favorite piece that I've been able to collect is this video from the 1994 summer CES that was described in the book, where Peter Main, George Harrison, Bruce Donaldson, and Randy Pergsman are dressed up like safari explorers and going into the jungle looking for that next great hit that will take Nintendo back to the top, which turned out to be Donkey Kong. Mm-hmm. But it was just, you know, amazing to see these 40 and 50 year old guys dressed up and playing around so much. There's so much great stuff out there. That was, you know, part of the reason to do the documentary and why I didn't feel like it really, you know, told the same story as the book or that it would overlap too much. There's just so much great content out there that, as the book subtitle tries to express, you know, I think it defined the generation. I think that this battle is so much of a touchstone for those of us that grew up during that era, and the media is really what brings you back instantly.
Yeah, two things about that. First off, you know, when we're talking Nintendo in 94, so they're getting some pretty good competition from Sega at the time. The new consoles aren't out just yet. And, you know, when I started seeing, like, again, going back and seeing videos or seeing, I think you actually have pictures of it in your book of that scene. I'm going to open up, because you got in the middle of the book, you actually, oh, there's a couple pictures where they're playing Donkey Kong and they're wearing their safari outfits. But, you know, just seeing like Nintendo saying, all right, you know, we have to be a little bit more fun. We have to be a little bit more easygoing and, you know, let down that huge wall that we have in terms of, you know, being so closed off and not being like, they just, like, Sega was looking like so much fun. And Nintendo just wasn't.
I mean, and the most interesting part to me of that is that they actually sort of apologized for not doing certain things. Yeah. And this is a company that still never really even acknowledged their competitor by name. Mm-hmm. But this was the one time I felt like they were like, all right, guys, we realize what's going on here. And they weren't just, you know, spewing out the same propaganda as always.
With the book and just in the, as I've gotten older, I was a huge Nintendo fan back in the day. We had the NES. We had the Super Nintendo. I eventually got a Sega Genesis the year before N64 came out. But as soon as that came out, I was back on the N64. And really, the next Sega console I ever got was the Dreamcast. But for me, I think this has been just a really fantastic experience looking back. Because now when I start looking at my games I enjoy today, I've been playing a lot more of the Sega Genesis stuff just because I either missed out on it or I'm like, yeah, this is actually pretty fun. And maybe I was part of the problem back in the day, just like being so far on one side. I just wanted Nintendo to always have the best version of everything. So I was wondering if you've had any other experiences from people talking to you like that. Like, maybe this book has kind of just said, you know, just made them more of a, a fan of Sega because they, not just because they were the underdog, but you know, just because they felt like the good guys in this fight.
That's a great point. I think some of the best compliments that I've received or best reactions to the book is people saying, I grew up as a Nintendo kid, but man, I got a lot of respect now for what Tom was doing at Sega, or just, you know, to pick up those games and start seeing like, oh, I don't have to hate these things. I can actually enjoy both. I think that's been really good. Like, I think I might have said last time on the podcast, the best reaction for me really is people just picking up their systems and playing again. And it's nice to hear people play the other system, the one they didn't play when they were younger. And for other people, too, it's the Super Nintendo. I mean, just because the book is so much about that era, even though it doesn't discuss the Super Nintendo and Nintendo side as much, just, you know, being reminded of that time period and realizing how much stuck one way or another we were for whatever reason. So there are a lot of people too, sort of seeing it from the other side of Nintendo.
The book came out at the perfect time because it also coincided with the release of this cool new hardware called the Retron 5, which allows you to play Sega Genesis games, Super Nintendo, Famicom, NES, like all these games, you know, through HDMI to your, you know, current day televisions, because how many people are still holding on to their tube TVs. But we talked briefly about this off the air, but I think you are partially to blame, you and your book are partially to blame for the huge inflation of video game prices on eBay and throughout the world, just because, you know, people are like, oh yeah, I remember that stuff, I want to go play that stuff again. So I wanted to ask you, since you know the book has come out and just in the last couple of weeks since we talked, have you been picking up any old stuff? Because I know you also bumped into Josh Hillier, co-host on the podcast in New York, like right outside Video Games New York, right?
Yeah, there was an event it was like a launch party for the Retron 5, and they also tied it together with an author signing for the book, and that was where I ran into Josh. I haven't picked up anything in the past few weeks, mostly because I haven't really had much time to play, but that's interesting that you say that. Why do you think it is that people do want to buy these old games when there is the opportunity to play them on emulators? Do you think that there's, you know, it's a special process to, you know, actually play the old game on the system, or there's something nice about just the aesthetics of the cartridges and potentially the cases if they still have those?
Oh, I think it's both. That is this podcast. It is being nostalgic for, you know, having that cart, it's having that plastic, seeing that label, you know, using the original controllers and stuff like that, and trying to, for me, it's mimicking that experience as much as possible from the like late 80s and early 90s. That's why if you go on eBay, like, you can get a loose cart for not too much money, but if you want it with like the box and the instructions, you're going to be paying 2-3 maybe even 4 times as much money for it.
Right.
But I don't know. I look behind me and I have, I don't know, like 150 maybe old carts of games. And it's just nice to, that's my bookshelf. You know what I mean? I got a bookshelf too, but you know, when, you know, my friends come in and they see that, like, oh my God, you got Yoshi's Island 2, you got Mega Turrican. Like, oh man, I remember that game. And it's just great because it just stirs up old memories more than just, like, the worst way for me to play a game is in an emulator with like a list of 700 games there, because they don't have value to me. They have, when I go and spend $50 on a game on eBay, it's like an investment. It's like back then when you would go to the store and buy an actual game, or even today, you're not just going to throw it up on the wall and forget about it. You're going to make sure you actually play it.
Yeah. Well, it's also kind of like buying a little bit of a piece of art and then
totally
playable piece of art. Yeah. No, I feel the same way. Even just, you described it as like your bookshelf, even with books. I certainly have nothing against ebooks, but I feel like when I read something, I want it to be like that process of, I've invested $25 in this physical thing. And I also think that there's a marketing aspect to the experience of, you know, every time you pick up the book, every time you pick up the old game and you're seeing the label, you're seeing the box, you know, it changes your experience to a small degree that you wouldn't get from playing it on an emulator or reading the book electronically with, you know, not having that constant reminder of those aesthetics.
Yeah, and I think Nintendo has by far the best the best service for this stuff with their virtual console on the Wii U and the 3DS, and they do an okay job with displaying that stuff on your console. But I think there's a really missed opportunity there to, like, when you buy a game on virtual console to download it, you have the game, but you also have like a virtual 3D box that you can turn around and look at the box and you can flip through the instructions. Just because it's, you know, you're still spending $8, $10, $12 for a game, you know, at least, you know, put some more work instead of just, you know, dumping the ROM and making it work right. For me personally, but yeah, this is, it's crazy because we're getting to that age where we can buy that stuff. So people are, you know, not worrying about spending $50 on a game they absolutely love.
Yeah.
So we also had a little bit of a conversation back and forth on Twitter about, you know, stuff in video game magazines, because I just discovered archive.org, or at least to the point where, like, oh my God, people are backing up old video game magazines too. Like, it's not just, you know, Shakespeare and, you know, Moby Dick. I can actually go on there and get stuff that I want to check out. And there's some awesome stuff. Like, I was going through, there's about maybe a dozen issues of GamePro from 96 to 97 up there that people have digitized. And it's like the perfect time. It's like right when, you know, it was hitting the fan at Sega. And there's just a lots of back and forth and stuff like that. So I was wondering for the documentary, how much are you planning on focusing on, you know, the complete, you know, downfall of Sega, like that Sega Saturn era where they just made a lot of, you know, bad decisions?
Probably a similar amount as in the book. You know, mostly this was something that we really considered because, you know, the Nintendo launch story and the success that they experienced with the 8-bit NES as well as the era before that are all really interesting. So we didn't know if we should really try to tell more of an encyclopedic history of video games or whether we really should try to narrow focus to the battle between Sega and Nintendo. And in the end, that's what we wanted to do because I thought that that's what we could really get into in depth and do a good job of. So probably the third act of the film is when you start to get into that next generation of consoles and start to see the development of the Sega Saturn and also what could have been with Sony and Silicon Graphics and sort of get to see those all the rumors of what was going on and also the ads for the Saturn trying to just be, you know, a complete style over substance situation. Mm-hmm. You know, the narrative follows a pretty similar path as the book, but there is so much great stuff out there in magazines. And this was also the time where, you know, VHS is even becoming a lot more popular. So there was a lot more promotional videos, which there weren't very much of in the early 90s. Some of the ads for the PlayStation I found surprising. Some of the commercials, they really were like Sega types of ads, but it's like one step further.
Well, it was like that. I remember specifically, I think it was the Crash Bandicoot ad with the with the megaphone, and he was just like standing outside Nintendo just like talking lots of crap about the N64.
Yeah,
good on them. That's what I mean. Sega did it and it worked, and you know, Sony just mimicked them enough to clearly they're on their fourth PlayStation, so that's been going all right.
Yeah, it worked pretty well for them.
So again, kind of going down, like there's like a lot of stuff that I wanted to bring up and talk about. But so this we got a little bit of a question like this on Twitter, too. But the way that I wanted to phrase it was in the last interview that we had, you mentioned having some resistance, understandably, from Nintendo and Sega when it came to researching the book. Like you were kind of, you know, digging up some dirty laundry and stuff. So have either parties really changed their stance or, you know, loosened up since the announcement of the movie and the documentary?
Yeah, actually. I was surprised by the reaction at first, though I guess when I thought about it some more, I shouldn't have been. And the reaction has generally been that Sega has wanted nothing to do with me, really, or not been very responsive at all and not had anything to say to me, whereas Nintendo has continued to be more supportive as they, you know, they, as they started to become much more helpful to me in the last few months of finishing the book, and did get me access to speak with Howard Lincoln and with current employees of the company. And when I was at E3, I met with Cindy Gordon, the head of corporate communications, who had helped me get those interviews. And she was extremely nice to me. She said she really enjoyed the book, could see how it could be a great movie, and invited me into the Nintendo booth. I got to meet with Reggie, the current president of Nintendo of America. Couldn't have been nicer to me. And I was, you know, maybe I, because I always imagined the book as, you know, Sega's victory over Nintendo. Mm-hmm. I didn't really consider the last 20% of the book where Nintendo kind of has their victory over Sega. And because of how the events played out in the book, Sega of Japan now does control almost all of Sega. So I guess it shouldn't have surprised me that they were not big fans of the book.
Yeah, I think Nintendo still gets a bad rap for being still, you know, heavily controlled by Nintendo of Japan. Even in America, they seem to be a little bit tight, you know, tight-lipped when it comes to stuff. Their PR is generally a little bit vanilla.
Yeah.
But it is kind of cool to hear that they're, you know, they're the ones opening up, and hopefully, I don't know, maybe just Sega sees no real opportunity in it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, they clearly don't, or they have a funny way of showing it. Hmm. But that is strange to me because, you know, maybe some dirty laundry is aired in the book, but because the focus of the book is more on these characters and it's not, you know, I'm not looking to tell sex scandals or, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff that would be particularly embarrassing to them. You know, in the end, I think that the discussions that the book has brought about, the success that it's found, and hopefully the success that the movie and documentary will find, will only help the company by getting the name out there. And, you know, in the same way that Social Network is maybe not particularly flattering to Mark Zuckerberg or Facebook, I think that that movie was a great promotional vehicle for the company. Hmm. So I would have hoped that they would have embraced that aspect of it, even if it wasn't in a public capacity. But they really haven't. I spoke with somebody. So I was at E3, and that was where I felt like I got a chance to see that reaction firsthand. I spoke with one person from Sega who said that they don't talk about the book, that they pretend that they're supposed to almost pretend like it doesn't exist. This is at Sega of America.
Yeah.
And then a reporter told me that he was speaking with some Sega people at a party and said, you know, I'm reading this book about Sega right now. And they're like, oh, is it Console Wars? And he said, yeah. And he said, is it really that bad between America and Japan? And they said, no comment, and sort of nodded. Hmm. So interesting times.
What a bummer, man. Like, it's just what it could have been, whether it had been that, you know, partnership, you know, that obviously the, with the PlayStation and with the people at Philips and stuff like that, are, oh man, there's just so many missed opportunities in this book for people out there. And, you know, it would have been nice to see Sega have a little bit of a better stance than they do today. I seem to think yeah. they're mostly just doing like portable games in Japan and like free to play stuff and maybe a Sonic game every year. That's about yeah. it.
I mean, it feels like a missed opportunity to me. They after the news came out that Seth and Evan were writing and directing the movie, they contacted me sort of full force and were very friendly to me and asked for copies of the book. And I got them everything they wanted, and then I never heard from them again. And I would have, whether or not they were really my friends or whether they were just wanted what they wanted, I would have expected that to continue for some time, because I would have thought that there'd be more stuff that they'd want down the line. So I'm surprised, and it feels like a missed opportunity on their end.
Do you know if the higher ups in Japan have really, has there been like a lot of turnover in terms of like the chairmen and the board members or anything like that? Or is it pretty much the same guys that have been there for, you know, 20 plus years?
It's not the same guys. That's why I kind of expected otherwise. Yeah. Nakayama left in, I believe, 2003, and almost everyone turned over because Sega was bought by Sammy.
That's right, yeah.
And I think the Sega Sammy company is very different than the Sega company described in the book. So I think that what I'm seeing from Nintendo is there's also been sort of a turnover, and they have they're looking at it through a lens of, wow, this happened 20 years ago, so let's just look at it as a historical incident, and, you know, it's not, you know, a description of the company nowadays, so we can enjoy it with you know, being removed. And that wasn't the reaction that I got from Sega, even though so much time has passed and that these are not the same people that were there back then.
You know, these days with Twitter and stuff like that, some of the, you know, developers that we remember growing up in the past are being a little bit more outspoken these days. I was wondering if there are any plans for you to head out back out to Japan and see if you can connect with any of these, you know, former, you know, whether they're developers at Sega or they're mostly working on Sega stuff. Is that... I mean, it's a reason to get out to Japan. So I don't know if there's any plans for anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are no specific plans at this point, but I'm still, you know, I started writing the book because I was curious about all this stuff. And 3 years, 3.5 years later, and finishing the book has not changed that at all. I have more questions than I did when I started. Hmm. So I definitely would love to get out there and try to speak with any developers that could help shed light on that era or other tangents of that era and this time period. So absolutely. And I do feel like even in just the past few months or, you know, I guess I feel like even Yuji Naka has started to talk a little bit more in the past few months. Mm-hmm. He did that interview about the Green Hill Zone in Sonic 1. And, you know, I always thought that, for better or worse, if the book can stir up more people talking, that would be a great thing, whether it was to dispute things said in the book or criticize things said in the book. At least people would be talking, ideally, Japanese businessmen and developers who historically have not said very much. So I feel like there's started to be that reaction as well, which is a very good thing.
It is just a really stark contrast. So when you go out to Japan and you go into the retro game shops and you see, you know, just huge rows and rows and rows of Sega Saturn stuff, where that, you know, in the US it was not a big hit, but it's the reverse for Mega Drive and Genesis stuff. There's a really small section for Mega Right. Drive stuff. It's super expensive. And, it just to help people get an idea of just how different things were. And even if the Saturn was a little bit more of a success in America, it probably could have pulled out just because of how popular it was in Japan. But like you mentioned before in the book, it's just the hardware was just fighting between, you know, Sega America and Sega Japan. And it just the wrong choices were probably made.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, to your point, maybe they weren't from their perspective, since it was a much better seller, the Sega Saturn was, over the Mega Drive in Japan.
Well, that's the problem. It's, you know, we have hundreds of millions of people, or a couple hundred million people in the United States versus, you know, tens of million in Japan. It's just there's just too many more people that needed to have their needs met. Like, the Genesis was gigantic here. I mean, you know that. It was just maybe a selfish decision on Japan's part. Say that. All right. So let's mix in some questions from the audience. We got some stuff in from Twitter. I thought this was a good question from Tobias. Actually, I think this might have been from NeoGaf. I'm not sure. But Blake, if you could include any one game with each copy of your book, what would it be and why?
So That's a fantastic question.
Yeah, what's the pack in? What's the pack in for the book?
We might have to talk this out. I mean,
yeah, let's have a discussion.
You know, what comes to mind is Sonic or Sonic 2, because one, that was, you know, what sort of defined Sega, and also because that's what helped Sega the Genesis, you know, bundling the first Sonic 1 and then also Sonic 2. Hmm. I have my not for resale copy of Sonic 2 that I got when I was a kid. But I do feel like part of what the book strives to be is to show a different side than people thought before, or, you know, sort of give you the opportunity to know what else is out there.
Really should be a Sonic game.
But what first came to mind was Toe Jam and Earl, which just to me was a classically Sega game that probably wouldn't have existed on Nintendo. It's weird, it's quirky, but it's also a lot of fun. We'll be right back. Are you a fan of Toe Jam and Earl?
I have probably never played more than 3 minutes of that game in my life.
Well, hopefully you'll change that. It's pretty fun about these two very strange guys.
I just bought the remake on the PlayStation Network for 99 cents. The other day, they had a really nice flash sale on the PlayStation Network. So I'll give it a shot on there. The cart's just a little expensive these days. And I've seen video of it. But
expensive. That was one that I tried early on to get, and I still haven't purchased it yet. It is kind of much more expensive than I would have expected.
They did take more chances, and maybe it would be, obviously Sonic or Sonic 2 is the right choice. It's definitely not Altered Beast. I don't think that pack-in sold a lot of consoles. Maybe Vector Man, that was a really weird game that they had later in the generation. But I mean, maybe Echo the Dolphin. Like, there was some weird stuff that was only on, when I think of Sega, I think Echo, like you said, Toe Jam and Earl, it's Sonic. It was Vector Man, like, later in 95. Maybe Virtua Racing, which was like $100 for the cart of that when it came out. But that would be a really expensive book if you had to do that.
I guess also, I mean, it wasn't a first party game, but Mortal Kombat as well would be.
Yeah.
A good one that brings back memories of people playing it in the arcade. It also did define the difference between Sega and Nintendo with the different versions. And it's also just a really, really easy one to jump into and just say, all right, I know how to kick and punch. Let's get going here.
I was thinking you were going to say NHL 94. Or...
Well, that would be very self-serving, I felt like.
Fair enough. The more that I've gotten into the Sega library, the more that I found that there is just a hidden treasure trove of, and this wasn't my type of game back then, but I'm starting to appreciate it more, is, you know, the vertical and the horizontal, like, space shooters and, you know, plane shooters and stuff like that. Like, there are dozens of fantastic shooters on that console that on the Super Nintendo side you didn't really have as much. You had your R-types, and you had, you know, Thunder Force, or there was a Thunder Force game that Thunder Spirits, I think, that came out on Super Nintendo, but there were far fewer on that console than there were on the Sega Genesis.
Yeah, I think as you look down the roster, you start to see a lot more of Sega's roots as an arcade company.
Totally.
In there, and the kinds of games that they make even to today, which are a little bit bloodier, edgier, shoot 'em up types of games, and they do a really good job at that.
Yeah, I still love going into the Club Segas in Japan and seeing the newest stuff that they have out there. Like, it's still amazing that they are putting out brand new arcade games up until this date. And it's not just, you know, the next Virtual Fighting 6 or whatever. There's tons of brand new stuff that's coming out that, you know, will probably eventually make it to a home console. But it's just it's great to see that they're keeping that part of my nostalgia alive.
Yeah, well, as somebody who has been to the Club Sega and sort of been to Japan, how would you describe, as someone who hasn't, how popular arcades really still are in Japan, and particularly how popular Sega's games are, or sort of even just the ambiance that they create around it?
Oh, it's fantastic. That was the first thing I did when I got to, well, you go to Akihabara, which is like the main place where people go for video game stuff. And even in Shinjuku, where I stayed the first time I went out there, there are Club Segas and what are called Taito Game Stations or Taito Game Centers. I think it's Taito Game Stations all over the place, which will be like 5, 6, or 7 floors of, you know, compact floors. Everything goes up. It's not necessarily as wide in Japan, but there'll be floors and floors of video games. One floor will be like the gachapons. There'll be like UFO machines, which will be like your claw games and your prize games and things like that. But when you get to the second floor, third, fourth floor, you have a floor dedicated to fighting games, like your Street Fighters, your Virtual Fighters, your Tekkens, all those games, your Blaze Blues. And then you go up another floor, and then you have what will tend to be like more of a retro game setup, where they'll have, you know, games from the 90s. They'll still have like beat 'em ups. Like, you'll see Final Fights up there. You'll see Neo Geo system set up there for all like the great Neo Geo MVS games, and then you go up another floor, and then it gets kind of weird again, where there's horse racing simulators, and you might go up another floor, and it's like all games for girls and for women, and you know sometimes guys, that where it would be like fashion design games and stuff like that. You'll see a wide demographic in those locations, but at the same time, there's going to be plenty of crazy, you know, hardcore games going on at once, and the place will be full of cigarette smoke because it's still okay to smoke pretty much everywhere in Japan.
But yeah, I mean, just to have that many stories of a arcade center, I don't even know where you would find such a thing in America. Like what what city or where would you would even have such a big exposure to it? And they have several of these throughout Tokyo. So,
oh, they're all over the place. Yeah. I mean, even if you go to smaller towns, you'll always find like a mom and pop arcade with 50 yen games and they're older machines, but it's just a part of the culture there where for us, like we just, like you play the latest Call of Duty, then you completely forget about it and you just move on to the next thing. You don't necessarily go back and play the, you know, the old games as much.
Right, right.
But I mean, you're in New York. Is there anything out there? I know there used to be like a Chinatown arcade or something like that, but did you ever see anything that's in the city?
There's like very, very little. There's a place called Barcade in Brooklyn that has old arcade games, but it's more so for just the retro nostalgia and a place to hang out and drink, which is probably perfect for me. But you know, it's not really catering to a game loving audience as much as I remember that type of audience. But no, I mean, that's why I'm was surprised when I was in Japan to see not just one of these five or six story arcade centers, but several of them, where in New York, there's not even like a floor where you could play arcade games or where you find people. I mean, I think I had my 28th birthday at Dave and Buster's in the city. That was the only place where I thought you could actually play these games. I guess it really is, you know, that's the only place that had the newest arcade games as well as some other ones and people pretty aggressively playing it.
Well, that's it. It's Dave and Buster's. It might be like a small spot in the mall with gross looking games that probably, you know, half of them don't work or.
Yeah.
I was just out in Chicago for business a couple of weeks ago. And that is like a mecca for arcade manufacturers and things like that. Like that's where Midway was, you know, based out of, you know, Bally's arcade, pinball machines and things like that. And, you know, around there, barcades are huge. So I was able to go out to a barcade that had like 30 arcade machines and, you know, a dozen, you know, pinball tables. But although I left with the high score on Donkey Kong, I was disappointed to see like the arcade machines were not kept up. Like I almost wanted to go up to the guy at the bar and say, like, can I have like a screwdriver and I'll just fix a bunch of your, like, I'll have more fun just fixing your machines and getting them up to, you know, running the way they should. Like this monitor's off, like the colors are off and things like that. Just give me, you know, 45 minutes and a screwdriver and I'll fix all this stuff for you. But, I miss that too. That's why it's like all these arcade machines are in people's houses now. Like I know people with basements full of arcade machines, which is a little envious.
Yeah, I would like to have that.
You're gonna have to move to like Jersey or something, right? You're gonna get a house and get a basement full of arcade machines.
That would definitely be the main reason to move out of an apartment. Yeah, I mean, I don't even hear there's not even any room for such a thing, but I would be envious as well. It's at E3. Some people were showing me photos of pinball machines and arcade cabinets they've been able to acquire, and they're just fantastic.
Yeah, it's good that they're keeping that stuff alive. Some of them get stripped for parts, but you know, a lot of them are staying alive. It's a cheap way to get into this stuff. Just look on Craigslist, guys. You can find something if you have the room and you have the time and the patience to get that thing working again. So some more questions from the audience. You hit on this a little bit before, but I've actually never said this name before, but we've gone back and forth a lot on Twitter. Slim Murakuji, I'm going to say that. Since publication, has Nintendo made any comments on record or off regarding console wars? And what about ex-employees? Have any employees kind of come out of the woodwork since the book came out and said, hey, actually, I have a story too?
Yeah, definitely. So Nintendo hasn't said anything publicly that I know of, but I also don't think that they should have. I mean, even when I would imagine they would support it, I don't think that they should plant a flag in this publicly, because, you know, it opens up people, it gives people a reason to be upset with them, or I don't know. They have enough problems, I guess I would say, that they don't need to do so. But I do feel like they've been very supportive, or as supportive as I would want them to be privately. And in terms of people coming out of the woodwork, so I did interview over 200 people for the book, and most of them were from Sega or third parties and other industry people, but a good amount were from Nintendo. And I would say that about 75% of them loved the book, and about 25% of them were very disappointed that it didn't talk about more, or that it didn't, you know, that the focus was more on Sega and their success during that time period. But the best thing for me has been people coming out of the woodwork from both Sega and Nintendo to say, oh, you know, you missed this story, or, oh, did you even know about this? And at first, when I heard this, you know, I was kind of bummed, because you want to believe that you can throw a perfect game and that everything in the book is like this flawless experience that encapsulates everything. But then I quickly realized that that's impossible. And also that, as I said earlier, you know, I'm still just as curious about the subject matter as ever. And I would be a fool not to want to learn more and, you know, just keep going down this rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. So I've continued to conduct interviews with people and continue to make an effort to get to know more people. And whether this is for the purposes of being in the paperback version or whether this is just for my own personal curiosity, I don't yet know. But it's been rewarding to just continue to learn more about the story. And also with the documentary going on too, it doesn't hurt to have that outlet if, you know, some of these people come up with photos or links to videos.
Is there, I don't know if we talked about this on the first interview or not, but is there a timetable on the documentary on when that would be released? I know you guys are still working on it, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know if we talked about it, but so I'm directing it with my business partner, Jonah Tulis, and right now we are probably, I feel like, in the second half of post-production. We've already conducted... we did 15 interviews last year, or maybe it was 16, with all the main players in the book, with Howard Lincoln, Peter Main, Howard Phillips, Tom Kalinske, Al Nilsson, Paul Rio, Bill White, etc. So we have all that. It was, you know, really nice 3, 4, 5 hour interviews. So we got a lot of stuff. Sorry, can you still hear me, Kevin?
Oh, yeah, I got you.
Okay, sorry. My computer's what kind of crazy. Yeah, so we, you know, we're editing it right now, and we are hoping to have something done by early fall, and you know, then sort of go into the final touches of post production with doing sort of animation and titles and sound and color correction. So, you know, in the end, it's going to be probably a decision made by Seth Rogen, Scott Rudin, and Evan Goldberg about what we do and when we do it. But I think that we can have something really nice ready by early 2015.
Great. So that's not too far off.
No, it's not. You know, as much as I groaned about the idea of doing the documentary and shooting it while I was writing the book, and a part it was, now it's sort of getting to the point where it's like, oh, yeah, well, that was probably a really good idea, because now – we have so much of it done, and we're not too far away from having something that's presentable.
I'm curious, is this something that you guys are looking for, like a theatrical release, or is this more of like a, you know, Amazon on demand? Like, I know a lot of videos are like on demand on day one and stuff these days now.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. As a filmmaker, I want it to be in every theater in every city in the world. But I also know that, you know, our producers, those three guys, you know, they are also doing, you know, the feature film is very much in their crosshairs, and, you know, they have much more experience with the stuff than I do. So I defer to their judgment, but certainly we've created it in a way that, you know, we hope it would be entertaining for 90 minutes or so for a theatrical audience.
Very cool. I can't wait to check this stuff out, and, we need more and more of this stuff. I It's awesome that I'm very happy that you guys, I know when the movie was officially announced, like a lot of people were like, oh no, I want like the King of Kong. I want like the documentary. I want to see the people and stuff like that. So it's awesome to see that you guys are really kind of like satisfying, you know, every audience.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel like we're leaving no stone unturned with that. I know that some people have reacted to the book with the dialogue and been like, I'd rather hear these people say it, or, you know, have it come in their own words. Okay, well, you will have that in a documentary format. And then also in sort of for a bigger budget mainstream audience, we'll have the feature film. So unless we get into the trading cards, you know, we've pretty much maximized every area.
Obviously. Yes.
And like, you know, I think we talked about it last time that part of my desire to write this book was just because there's so little out there about the gaming industry, especially presented in a way for non-gamers to sort of get, you know, put their foot through the door and see what this world is all about. And so I'm really excited about that. And I do feel like the book has started to make a little bit of a difference in terms of getting people interested in the industry and just sort of seeing this other side to this thing that, you know, has been so prevalent and so successful from a business standpoint for many years, and really just starting to see like, oh, wow, there are people behind the scenes, whether it's the developers who are actually making these things that we play or the people who are responsible for getting it into our hands and making us know about what's out there.
Nice. I want to get my Tom Klinsky playing card or trading card and stuff like that. And it's weird. I'm having flashbacks because I was at a flea market this morning and someone had like they had baseball cards, and they also had like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the movie cards, like in packs, like still. And I totally forgot, like, every movie that came out, even Super Mario, I think it was Super Mario Brothers, the movie, also had, like, trading cards and things like that with characters from the movie on it and stuff. So, yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Why? There were so many. I remember, like, there was, like, Dick Tracy cards.
Yeah.
Movie cards.
Holy crap.
Were people really buying all these cards? I guess I was, if I'm remembering them.
Well, it would be the case for me where maybe I'd see him at a checkout and I would get one pack of cards, and I'd only have one pack of cards for the whole life of that series. And I would never like collect more of them. It was just be like on the whim where I could convince my parents to drop $1 or $1.50 on some, whether it was Dick Tracy cards or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Super Mario Brothers or whatever to buy that stuff for me. But, I guess there's go on eBay. There's clearly still that guy was selling them for $1. So you can still get sealed packs of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the movie cards, for not too much. Okay, so this is a little bit of a specific question from NeoGAF, from Guy Kazama. I would like to know if Blake was able to get in touch with David Rosen. I would have loved to know his opinion of Sega post Dreamcast. He's been pretty quiet since retiring. I haven't seen an interview with him in print since the late 90s.
That is an excellent question. So I was in Los Angeles for E3 a couple of weeks ago, or whenever that was, and I did get to spend 4 hours with David Rosen. And he is a really interesting guy. I didn't speak with him very much for the book because he is a very private person. He doesn't really give public interviews. Mm-hmm. And I think that he was reluctant to do so. When we were talking a couple weeks ago, he said that he had been approached so many times about someone doing a Sega project and nothing had really materialized. So he was, he was kind of skeptical and wished that he had spoken with me more. And I apologized to him for saying, I wish I had been much more aggressive in trying to get you to speak with me. But I think in the end, we realized like there's still an opportunity to hear more about his experiences, whether it is for further editions of the book or also just to help, further cement his legacy. And I'd love to write something about him, whether it's an interview or a short article that really gets into how many things he did to really make Sega exist and then continue to exist. You know, he bought and sold Sega several times, and he sort of was the godfather behind the scenes for this company. So I don't have any really specific things that he said about Sega in the post Saturn in the book era and also the post Dreamcast era. But if anyone really knows the story from start to finish, it's definitely David. I mean, not only did he start it, but he was around for all those times. And he was there before, during, and after Tom Kalinske. So he has a pretty interesting experience with all this. And that's something that I'm hoping to learn more about. It was really nice. I met with him. We met in his office for a few hours and went out to dinner. And then he said that he thought he might have some old VHS tapes related to Sega stuff from the Master System and the Genesis era. And I went back the next day, and he had seven VHS tapes of mostly commercials from the Master System era and the Genesis, the early Genesis era, which we're going to be using for the documentary. So that that was really great, because I'm now I'm just obsessed with collecting media.
I got to make sure to get you, if you haven't already, to get you in contact with a couple of people. Right off the top of my head, I'm thinking Steve Lin, who got a bunch of stuff from Nintendo. I think it was from Howard Phillips that he got it. It was that, I always get the names mixed up. It was the person that was the game master.
Yeah. Howard was the game master. Okay. Howard was so helpful to me with photos from that era.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
And it definitely, he was like, he's a pack rat, and he definitely had access to all that great stuff. So it definitely got to be Howard Phillips.
I there was a great quote in one of the videos that I was watching last night, just like as I was like prepping for the interview. I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to jump on YouTube, see if there's any new stuff on there. And there was a great video. It was that frontline piece where, you know, Sega had the more powerful hardware. It's like, yeah, Nintendo is like, they got the same price and the thing's been out for like 6 years and they're just like, you know, reaping all the profits. And he was in one of the clips saying, like, you know, it's not how powerful the console is. It doesn't matter how powerful it is if you don't have good games. I'm like, oh man, he's talking some crap right at Sega.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't realize they were that direct, but yeah, it was a pretty, you know, vicious fight between those two guys, even with him. And then He almost worked for Sega.
I know. I love that story so much. One thing David told me that I thought was really interesting was, and it sort of has parallels to the PlayStation Sega stuff in the book, was he said that at the 1989 CES show, they had balloons that said Sega Genesis, 16-bit Genesis, you know, 16-bit Revolution or something along the lines of better technology. The Nintendo guys were popping the balloons back at that show, which was kind of like Steve Race popping balloons 6 years later. But I thought that was kind of interesting, because I always imagined very early on that Nintendo just didn't even have any regard for Sega, but I guess they had enough regard to try to burst their bubble, literally.
Well, it's so awesome that you're at E3, because it is almost like everyone, less on Sony's side, but everyone's just like congratulating everyone right now. Like Microsoft came out and said, we just want to say, you know, I think Nintendo and Sony are doing a great job. Like man, he actually is like congratulating Sony and Nintendo for having great stuff out there. Like, this is like, what world am I living in right now? You know, PlayStation, not so much, but it was just funny just coming off of, you know, reading the book and then going into E3 and like seeing that everyone's just like trying to be nice to each other, whether it's for PR or for not.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like that. It probably is for PR. I mean, I can't look into the soul of a man and say what his true intentions are, but you know, it was one of the nice things about the era that I wrote about for the book is that it's kind of like that thing that you might say about like presidencies, like, you know, I think stuff that presidents in the 50s, 60s and 70s, and even before that they did never could have passed today because people would have reported about it, made scandals about it. But back then it was sort of just underreported. There was a little bit more of things going on under the radar, and Sega and Nintendo could have sort of more of that war of words, because it wouldn't become a headline on IGN the next day that says like Peter Main says Tom Kalinske's a liar, and then have 60,000 people read it and comment about it. And that gave people a little bit more leeway to say how they really felt and not just how they felt it should play in the media.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, and we got a couple questions along these lines, and you hit on it in the previous interview, but in case anything had changed up until this point, obviously this was you know, I guess this was like the bloody war. Like this was maybe this was our World War One. Like it was just vicious. Like there was nothing pretty about it. Not that there's anything pretty in any war, but there, you know, later on there was another war between Nintendo, Sony, and then the newcomer Microsoft coming in with their Xbox, and that was starting from zero, another war, and it seemed like everyone kept changing their tactics. Like there was specific, you know, roles. Like the, you know, Xbox was being like Sega, and then Sony was being like Nintendo, and Nintendo was being like Sony, and like they all kept like rotating roles based on who was presenting at E3 or who was just running the show. Does that interest you? To I know it's not as, you know, historic or as old these days, but it was still like 10, you know, 12, 15 years ago now.
Yeah, no, it definitely interests me. You know, the one thing that I've probably thought more about in the past month or 2 months since the book came out, or since I haven't been really writing it or working on it anymore, that I hadn't been thinking before is, you know, I tell the story from A to B, from 1985 to 1995, but I never really thought too much about that time from 1996 to where we are today. And I have been thinking about that a lot. And one of the things that's really struck me is that, you know, Sega and Nintendo, both of them, for the most part, had their pedigree in making arcade games, in making video games. And so the transition of the console business is, you know, it's not an easy feat, but it's one that they at least had like the minor league system of games, or at least they had the background in games to kind of jump in. And if you look at today, you know, Sony and Microsoft are the leaders of the current generation of the console wars, and neither, you know, both of them do not come from a arcade or a video game background. Microsoft comes from a computer background, and Sony comes from a consumer electronics background. And sort of the shift that I see over time is that Xbox, you know, I know got into the console business because they mostly because they saw Sony in there, and they wanted to, they didn't want to be left out of the living room, you know, and they wanted to have that device, which now they have with the Xbox One, which, you know, it is supposed to be that one living room device, and have that purpose. And so it's just interesting to see these companies and the roles they play based on what sort of assets they bring to the table in that respect. And I'm definitely interested in the next generation with the Dreamcast and the GameCube. And
oh, man, the Dreamcast, such a missed opportunity. I love my Dreamcast.
Great console.
Yeah, it's like I think if you just go by the library itself, like there are more quality games, you know, in terms of the ratio on that console than anything else that was ever put out there, except maybe the Neo Geo Pocket Color. Like,
yeah, it was great.
It was so good.
Did you see that that article or that quote recently from Peter Moore at Electronic Arts saying that console wars are good for the industry?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at it right now, and by the way, Peter Moore, he doesn't get to talk enough like that. I loved him. Like, he almost sold me. He probably sold me an Xbox 360 when he was with Microsoft. And I think if you just look at what's going on between Sony and Microsoft right now, like they are beating the crap out of each other and we are winning. Like, you're seeing the Xbox get the Kinect taken out, so it's at $400. And you're also seeing like huge, like I got a PlayStation 4 for $359 on eBay from eBay with no tax. Like they're fighting so hard to just get consumers right now. It is the best time.
Yeah. No, I mean, I always am surprised. I see a lot, you know, I do search for console wars sometimes on social media or the internet, and people complain about how the console wars are so stupid and how it's just, you know, being pushed, you know, it's a media agenda because it's exciting, maybe, but like we're the winner. We're definitely, if anyone wins the console wars, it's definitely us. It's better prices and better products. And so I emailed Peter after I saw that comment and said, you know, I think that you would like the book. And he said, yeah, definitely. So I sent him a copy and I said, if there was ever a sequel, I think it would have to star him, since he is so quotable and since he was there during the Dreamcast era.
Yeah, I mean, not only the Dreamcast, but then he was right there when Microsoft, you know, started doing some really great stuff with the 360, when he was the voice of them on the press conferences and stuff like that. He's such a showman, and it's a bummer to see that he's kind of like behind the scenes now at EA Sports, but I guess he got promoted from EA Sports. But anyways, yeah, lots of cool stuff. All right, so I've wasted an hour of your Sunday.
Not a waste at all.
So I think we'll cap it off there. But I like this trend. I think this would be cool to talk to you again in a couple months, just to see, you know, the progress with obviously the documentary and you know, as news comes on when that's going to be released and things like that, to get you back on to talk again. And if you're interested down the road, just coming on like a regular, you know, the regular setup for the episodes where we just, you know, hang out and talk about a game, like just talk about whether it's NHL 94 or maybe you do Toe Jam and Earl. Maybe we have you on for that, but that would be great as well.
Yeah, obviously I really enjoy speaking with you, so let's definitely do that. And specifically in terms of the NHL 94, no, I'm not pushing this agenda, but I am going to be, there have been some people ask me, you know, if I'm going to write more about video games or whether this was the end of my time. And I don't know if I'm going to write another book, but I definitely have come across so many interesting characters and games and stories that I want to write some articles. And the first one I'm going to write is about NHL 94 and sort of a behind the scenes of how that was made or what was interesting about that game and what made it special. And I'm writing it for Darren Wall, who's the guy who in England, who's doing that Genesis book, who's launching a website. He does the read-only memory thing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you can expect a piece from me on NHL 94. Maybe that could lead to a conversation that we'll have about it, or maybe just people will get to see why I love it so much. But yeah, let's definitely chat again. I'm happy to talk about the doc in a few months, or in the meantime, just jump on a show and talk about one of the great games of yesteryear.
Very cool. Well, obviously, mentioned before, but the book is Console Wars, and you can get access to that on your local retailer, whether it be Amazon, Audible.com has a fantastic version if you are into the audio books and really anywhere to get books, it's carrying it. I don't know if there's bookstores out there someplace, not yes. Near me as much, but I'm sure if you're in the city there are definitely some. But Blake, thank you so much for taking the time to come back on. It's always a lot of fun to talk about old games with you, man.
Yeah, Kevin, I had a blast. Thank you so much.